through Matthew 9 last time. We'll be picking it up in verse 18 today. Some things about Matthew that you're beginning to be able to associate and remember about him. And that has to do with Matthew's purpose in building his case that Jesus is the long-awaited Messiah, the one that the people were looking and waiting for. When we pick up in chapter 9, verse 18, it's a very unique healing story account. It is a sandwich where you have the synagogue ruler. In Matthew, he's just called the ruler. His daughter's death and Jesus raising her to life. But sandwiched in the middle of that is the woman with the hemorrhage that had the bleeding issue for 12 years. And these things are tied together in all three of the Synoptic Gospels. The stories follow very similar. Matthew, characteristically, is the briefest of the accounts. Mark is the longest, and then Luke is pretty long compared to Matthew, but Matthew condenses it down. But there's a similarity or a thread that ties all these together. And I'll show you those as we work our way down through them. It's what Matthew is very concerned about. And I'll show you as we work our way down. Verse 18. While he was saying these things, talking about what precedes it, he's talking about fasting and also the new wineskins and old wineskins. While he was saying these things, behold, a ruler came and knelt before him, saying, "My daughter has just died. But now come and lay your hands on her, and she will live." Now, Mark and Luke have a little bit different take on this. They say that the synagogue, they call him a synagogue ruler. Matthew doesn't. He just calls him a ruler, which there's no contradiction or anything. But following that, in Mark and Luke, he says that my daughter is at the point of death. But we have Matthew saying that she has died. Because in both Mark and Luke, as Jesus starts off with the synagogue ruler to go to his home, he's interrupted by the woman with the hemorrhage. And following that, when they start back, after they're done, Jesus is done with the woman with the hemorrhage, they start going again, and then he's met by messengers saying, "Don't bother the teacher anymore. Your daughter's dead. She's died." But Matthew, again, he condenses the stories. He doesn't bring all the details that the others do. But I want you to notice something. As Matthew records this, he had the ruler come to Jesus. He says, "My daughter has just died," or maybe it could be understood as a figure of speech. Basically, she's at the point of death. But this is what he says to Jesus. "Come and lay your hands on her and she will live." Now, you see that. Well, what do you mean? What do you see that? Well, what I mean by that is, notice that he believes. If you lay your hands on her, she'll live. Even though she's at the point of death. Or if she has just died. "And Jesus rose and followed him with his disciples. And behold, a woman who had suffered from a discharge of blood for 12 years came up behind him, touched the fringe of his garment, for she said to herself, 'If I only touch his garment, I will be made well.'" Now, do you see a similarity? In what the woman's experience, what she believed, and what the ruler here, even though he goes unnamed, we know his name is Jairus. Both people, both the Jairus and this woman who's ill, they believe. If they can just get to Jesus, he can do something about it. It's almost comical in one sense when you look at Mark's account, the longer account, because as they're moving through the crowd and the woman with the issue of blood or the hemorrhage here, she comes up in the crowd, works her way up where she can touch Jesus, and all she does is touch the hem of his garment. And Jesus stops, he freezes, and he says, "Who touched me?" Now, the humor in that is, Jesus, everybody's touching you or trying to touch you. But Jesus is wanting to find this one woman. Now, as we begin unpacking this, especially to deal with this lady, we do know some other details about her. One, all that she had spent on doctors to no avail. The doctors had done her, did her no good at all. She still has this bleeding issue. Secondly, though, a very important fact to remember, according to Leviticus, because of her consistent bleeding, she is unclean. And anyone who would touch her, or she would touch, would be considered, according to Levitical law, unclean. So here's the problem. She's in the middle of a crowd. Okay? So she is, by virtue of where she is running the risk of making other people ceremonially unclean. But even more than that, she is trying to get to Jesus. And if she touches even his clothes, he would be considered, according to Leviticus, ceremonially unclean. So you see the risk that she's taking. What if she's recognized in the crowd? Other people would obviously know about her condition. It has, it's not been a, probably something that's been hidden, especially for 12 years. Now here's a parallel that our particular passage in Matthew is not going to point out, but it's still true. How old was Jairus' daughter?
12.
How long has this woman been struggling with this issue?
12 years.
That's not by mistake. That's not a coincidence. It's important. It's maybe an incidental detail, but it's nevertheless a detail that is indeed important. So she's trying to get to him. And she is thinking to herself, if I can just touch his garment, I will be made well. Undoubtedly, she, along with Jairus, is well aware of the growing reputation of Jesus as being a one who has the authority and the power to heal. Now, but both of these people believe if they can get to Jesus, their particular challenge, issue, event, what's going on in their lives, he can make all the difference. Now, let's kind of take a side road for just a moment, kind of stop and think about it for a minute. Most every Christian will say, I believe that God answers prayer. Would anybody disagree with that? Probably not. But let me ask a little more pointed question. Do you believe God will answer your prayer? Some will, at weak moments, because of just being clay, is we'll acknowledge, well, yeah, God answers prayer, but we don't always think that he will answer our prayer for whatever reason. And maybe because we have prayed, and seemingly from our perspective, God did not answer, at least not in the way that we ask or anticipate. And you've heard probably in your lifetime hundreds of sermons directed about prayer, pray believing, and you've tried it. It's like a woman one day, she went to church, and the preacher that day preached on faith. Just faith the size of a mustard seed can move a mountain. And outside of her window, she could see a mountain. So she prayed fervently that God would remove that mountain. The next morning, she got up, went to that window, opened the shade a bit, looked out, and just like I thought, still there. Sometimes, when we really are really honest with ourselves and with others, you've prayed, God did not answer. Or, there's some reason for that, obviously. Well, somebody was sick, and they stayed sick. So, as you prayed fervently for. And then you read about someone like George Mueller. George Mueller, just a fascinating individual. He had several orphanages that he ran. Never asked money for people. He asked God to prompt people to give money to support the orphanage. But there was something like, and I don't remember the exact number. I'm just going to use a number. I think it was a little bit more than that. But anyway, Mueller had for years prayed for about 35 men to become Christians. About 32 of those men during Mueller's lifetime became Christians. Three did not. But as the account goes, when Mueller died at his funeral, the remaining three men became Christians. And if you read anything about Mueller, you just read absolutely fascinating answers to prayer. I mean, just absolutely fascinating. There's a book I can lay my hands on. It's written by a man named Laverne something. I don't remember his last name right now. But what it is, it's a book about God answering prayer. And there's some fascinating answers to prayer. And one in particular that I remember from that book was a woman, she was actually a doctor working with some tribal people in Africa. Now, this is several generation or two ago. So you didn't have rapid shipping or anything like that, or even rapid communication. But there was a baby born in that area, and the baby was a bit premature. And even though they were in Africa, there was concern about the baby staying warm enough to stay alive. So this doctor, as she was dealing with there, she had kids there that she was taking care of, some abandoned by the parents, some orphaned. And there's a little girl there that said, well, why don't we pray that God will send a hot water bottle. Now, it's going to take months to get something. And the doctor thought to herself, that's an exercise in futility, because there's no way one can get here soon enough, even if it was shipped today. But not to be outdone, she let that little girl pray. The little girl prayed for a hot water bottle for the baby, and said, and she also included, and God, if it's not too much trouble, include a dolly for me. Okay? That's how children pray. It was in just hours, an unexpected vehicle pulled in with a crate on it. And in the crate was sent by a group of ladies that were concerned about missions, and how they got connected, no one really understood it, but they sent a small, it wasn't a big crate, but a crate of supplies to this woman where she had this clinic, this doctor. And she was kind of nervous about what might be in it. So she cracked it open, and there was a lot of stuff in it. There was a hot water bottle in it. And then one of the last things they pulled out, guess what was in there?
A dolly.
A dolly. Now, God answered that prayer months before it was asked. Okay? Months before it was asked. So you hear about things like that. And we don't dispel it. We agree with it. But would God answer prayers for us that dramatically? These people, both people, are desperate. If your 12-year-old daughter is at the point of death or has just died, you're in a crisis. No question. And if you are a person who has been pretty much ostracized because of your consistent state of uncleanness and no doctor's been able to help you, you're kind of desperate. You're desperate. Both people, though, believe that Jesus can do something about it. And they don't just believe it, they actually are prompted to action to get to him. So Jesus turned, verse 22, seeing her, he said, "Take heart, daughter." This is, again, a bit of a reflection of what we saw last week when he's talking to the paralytic, "Your sins have been forgiven." He calls him son. So Jesus uses more intimate language referring to these people, even though obviously she's not his daughter. And the young man who is a paralytic, he's not his son. But Jesus uses those endearing statements in reference to them. He speaks kindly to this woman. And he says, "Take heart, daughter, your faith has made you well." And instantly the woman was made well. And when Jesus came to the ruler's house, you see, we're there now. We don't know how far away the ruler of the synagogue was living from where Jesus is at right here. But we're moved from this woman, his encounter with her. Now he's there at the house. And when Jesus came to the ruler's house and saw the flute players and the crowd making commotion, he said, "Go away, for the girl is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. Some things that kind of fill in the gaps for us here is the Jewish burial customs. Usually, burial was done rapidly when someone passed away. You didn't take a lot of time to do it. You would, sometimes that very day, the funeral would be taking place. But one of the customary things was that when someone passes away in Jewish culture, even if you're a very poor family, you need to hire mourners. There were women that you could hire to weep and to wail. And there were people you could hire that were flute players. And then, of course, friends and family would show up, and they would weep and wail. That was an indication to the person who passed away is important. If you didn't have anyone weeping and wailing, and then the wailing part was a part of the whole thing, it was really considered to be a very detrimental kind of thing. If, the negative thing, the person wasn't cared about much. So anyway, you'd hire the mourners. They come, you can tell they're professional mourners. They go from mourning to laughing just like that. You see that? They do. Jesus shows up and he tells them that the child's not dead, just sleeping. So they go from their wailing and their weeping to laughing. Why are they laughing?
Making fun of him.
Why are they making fun of him?
Because
she's dead. She's dead. Now, I know there are those cases where someone appears to be dead. But if you're around it very much, you can figure it out pretty quickly. You can tell. And I don't want to get into details, how or anything like that. Just know that you can tell. Anyway, so they're laughing at him. But when the crowd had been put outside, he went in and he took her by the hand, and the girl arose. And the report of this went through all the district, the whole area. It began spreading what took place. Now, what Mark tells us that that Matthew does not, is that Jesus not only put the people out of the house, he had with him only his three closest disciples, Peter, James, and John, and the girl's parents. Just the five people. Mark even uses the word that Jesus said, "Talitha cum," which means, "I say to you, girl, arise." That's Aramaic. Mark includes several of Aramaic words that Jesus actually said. He preserves those for us. And when she is raised up, Jesus says, "Give her something to eat." Here, those details are not given to us. It's simply that Jesus raised her from the dead. And he took her by the hand, and the girl arose, or she rose up. Now, again, what's going on in these two stories, two events? Well, what's going on is both people that are mentioned here particularly are expressing a belief, a faith, a trust that Jesus can do something. And both are in desperate straits, but they know that he can do something. So they not only know that knowledge prompts them to do something. You see this, the importance of that. I mean, the woman, because she could have stayed home and believed that Jesus could do it. Jairus could have stayed home and believed that Jesus could do it. But their desperation drove them to actually go to him. Questions or comments anyone might have?
It took a lot of courage on Jairus' part, plus faith, because he was in the synagogue.
Yeah.
The Pharisees were all Christians.
Yeah. There will be people, and I don't know if you've ever been here or there or not, but you may have been at one time or another. You probably haven't been. But if when you're pushed to the point of desperation, you don't care what anybody thinks. Or you don't care. If you see a glimmer of hope, you reach for it. I remember, again, reading an account of an atheist. You probably have heard the old adage, there's no such thing as an atheist in a foxhole. Well, in this particular case, there was an atheist that was in the hospital, and a buddy of his, who also claimed to be an atheist, was going to pay him a visit in the hospital. And when he got to the room, he walked in the room, and he was just astounded because his atheist buddy was on his knees praying. Why was he doing that? Because he's desperate. Now, he got a good ringing out from his so-called friend. If he was really an atheist, you wouldn't be doing that. But in desperate times, you don't care. You really don't. If you think here's the only hope that we have, who cares what anybody thinks? Anyway, having said that, what Matthew is wanting us to see is faith. But he wants us to see something else too. Do you remember what he said about the faith of those that brought the paralytic to him last week? There's a phrase. Three words. Begins with a participle. Seeing their faith. He said to the paralytic, "Son, your sins are forgiven." That's an intriguing statement. Another intriguing statement, at least to me, is what happens when Barnabas goes to Antioch. He goes to Antioch because there's revival going on there. He's been sent there by the brethren from Jerusalem. So Barnabas goes there and he sees the grace of God. I don't know if that strikes you or not, but it does me. What does the grace of God look like? What was it that Barnabas saw? Now, the only answer to that really from the text is the setting. You have Jewish and Gentile believers in the same church, getting along, loving each other, serving each other, serving with each other. And that is absolutely the move of God's grace that could even occur. So every once in a while, it'd be good to kind of mark those kind of unique statements. Here, you know, seeing their faith, and then here also the people believing and trusting, even when they would have probably good reason not to. especially like to consider the synagogue ruler. He may lose some respect from some of the others because he was so desperate to seek Jesus out. But he didn't care. He didn't care. Any other comments before we move any further?
I just like the word. You said that there was 5 people in the room.
Matthew doesn't tell us that.
Okay, that's what I was looking at.
But Mark does.
Well, I didn't look in the right place apparently.
Well, Mark's a much longer, more detailed account. Now we're going to do something that's characteristic of Matthew. Again, 2 blind men. Not 1, but 2. And you'll also find in parallel accounts, you'll find in Matthew, and in Luke and Mark, you'll find 1 blind man. When Jesus crossed over the lake into the area where Satan is king, there were 2 demoniacs, 2 demon-possessed men living in the tombs. Mark and Luke tell us about 1. So prepare yourself for some sort of skeptic saying there's a contradiction. Is there a contradiction? Was there 2 or was there 1? Same kind of details when you come to the tomb. How many women were there? Some accounts say this number, some accounts say that number. So is there a contradiction? The answer to that is no. No. Because we do this in everyday life too. We may, if there's a group of people and somebody says something, we may just refer to the person who speaks. He may not be alone, he may have other people with him, but the one who's speaking is maybe the one we will refer to. You follow what I'm saying? So a lot of the so-called contradictions are not that at all. Now that you stop and think about it. So he's going to talk about 2 blind men, Luke and Mark. They don't. They talk about 1, but not 2. Okay. What happens here? And as Jesus passed on from there, 2 blind men followed him, crying out, "Have mercy on us, Son of David." Now Jesus doesn't stop. He continues through the house. What house? Probably Peter's house in Capernaum. But notice what they're crying out aloud. "Have mercy on us, Son of David." That is not just a simple statement or one that sounds good or cool. It's a very important one. Who is the Son of David? What do they mean by the Son of David? Do they merely mean a descendant of David? Or do they mean something else by that title? It is. It's a messianic title. They're acknowledging, and in their cry following Jesus, they're referring to him as the Messiah, the Son of David, the one that was going to come. The promise that God made to David was simply, "Upon your throne you will have a descendant who will reign forever." Well, we know there's no king on David's throne. But they were waiting for one to come. Messiah, the anointed one. In Greek, it's simply called Christ. They all mean the same thing. Anointed one, Messiah, Christ. All 3 of those expressions mean the same thing. This is the anointed one, the one they were waiting for. Son of David. When he entered the house, the blind men came to him, and Jesus said to them, "Do you believe that I am able to do this?" Okay. Are you seeing a theme here? Jairus, the synagogue ruler, the woman with the issue of blood, the hemorrhage, and now these blind men. What do you see tying them together? What theme is it?
Faith.
It is. That's exactly right. "Do you believe that I'm able to do this?" They say to him, "Yes, Lord." Then touching their eyes, saying, "According to your faith, be it done to you." And their eyes were opened. And when Jesus sternly warned them, "See that no one knows about it," but they went away and spread his fame throughout all the district. Now there's an interesting detail here. And
There are miracles in the Old Testament. You're aware of that, right? But they're not... Those are not mentioned in the Old Testament. The only one that would come close to that is Elisha's servant, when Elisha sends him out and asks God to open his eyes, and he does, and he sees the armies of heaven surrounding Elisha. That would be, that wasn't from a blind person having their sight restored. Even when you get to the ministry of the apostles, you don't have mentioned, I'm not saying it didn't occur, I'm just saying we don't have a mention of the restoration of sight miracles mentioned in Acts and following. I don't know what necessarily to make of that, other than it was a messianic sign that the blind would receive sight. And when Jesus was asked by the disciples of John the Baptist, "Are you the one, or should we expect another?" Jesus did not say, "I'm the one." He simply said, "Go back and tell John what you have seen. The blind see, the lame walk, and the poor have the gospel preached to them." That's how he responded to that. So that indicates that. So here these blind men come. And they experience, they believe, they trust, they receive their sight, and they disobey Jesus. Do you catch that? How many of you would have disobeyed as well? Be honest. If you were blind, and Jesus healed you to now you see, are you going to be quiet about it? Even though it's not mentioned in this account, but it is in Mark and Luke, Jesus tells Jairus and his wife, "Don't tell anybody." Do you think they were able to keep it quiet?
What do you think he'd do that for?
Him? Well, I know why he does it in Mark, for sure.
Human nature to tell, so...
Oh, yeah. Well, in Mark's Gospel, we have a theme. It's called the Messianic Secret. Jesus does not want the news out too quickly that he is Messiah, because people misunderstood what that was going to look like. That's why he would shut up demons, and he wouldn't allow them to speak. And also he told people not to tell, just do this instead of tell. But here, we get a glimpse, he told them not to, they did it anyway, and his fame spread. But Mark tells us that it spread so much, he could not even enter a town anymore because of the number of people that were seeking after him.
But did he know what they were thinking and going
to
do?
Well, Jesus would have, he knew what was in the hearts of people. But he also knew the kind of difficulty their testimony was going to bring. However, on one occasion, Jesus does tell someone, "Go tell what God has done for you." Anybody remember who that was? The demoniac that was on the other side of the Sea of Galilee, on the Gentile side. He wanted to go with Jesus. Jesus says, "No, you go back to your people and tell them what God has done for you." So that was a different scenario. Anyway, let's look on, verse 32. "As they were going away, behold, a demon-possessed man who was mute was brought to him. And when the demon had been cast out, the mute man spoke. And the crowds marveled, saying, 'Never was anything like this seen in Israel.' But the Pharisees said, 'He casts out demons by the prince of demons.'" Okay. Some of the opposition to Jesus is beginning to increase. Okay? So what's going on here? Well, what's going on is this particular demon-possessed man could not speak. Could be that he may not be able to hear either. But anyway, when the demon is cast out, he can speak. And then, though, the people were amazed, and then the reaction of the Pharisees is somewhat, we might think, surprising. And the Pharisees, their response is, well, he cast out demons by the prince of demons. Now, Jesus, in other places, deals with that, talking about how illogical such a statement truly is. But let's deal with what the Pharisees are dealing with. Why would they draw that conclusion? Now, we'd have to consider a lot of parallel passages in Jesus' encounters with the Pharisees to fully understand this. But when you take all the different events together and look at the similarities, what was going on, it begins making sense. There's two sources of power in this world, spiritual power. Can you name them? God and the devil. Two sources of spiritual power. So when a demon is cast out, or even a person is healed, it doesn't come with a flashy neon sign and say power of God, nor power of Satan. It just is. It happens. So here are the Pharisees. And they're growing in hostility toward Jesus because he doesn't toe the line as they think he should toe the line. They believe that they are God's special people. And because of that, because they're the ones that keep the law. They're the ones that are righteous. They're the ones that care about the things of God and other people don't. So here comes Jesus, and he does not line up with them. He does not look like he's on their side. So if Jesus will violate the Sabbath by healing somebody on the Sabbath, it seems from their point of view logical that Jesus must be using a source of power other than God's power, or he would do the things that they do. Okay? If they believe that violating the Sabbath was in their mind, such a sinful thing to do, even though Jesus never did really violate the Sabbath, what he did do is he did not keep their rules about the Sabbath. That's two totally different things. So their conclusion is, since he's not on our side and we're on God's side, he must be on the other side, regardless of how stupid it is. And Jesus points that out in other places by simply saying, if Satan casts out Satan, his kingdom is divided and it's not going to stand. I mean, if an army fights among itself, it doesn't have to, you know, the enemy doesn't have to worry about them. They'll take care of each other, right? So that's why they're drawing an absolute ludicrous conclusion. It should have been, wait a minute, he's able to do this, meaning that he must be using God's power in to do this. But no, that's not even a possibility because he's not agreeing with us. You know, I have no desire to offend anybody, but I'm going to say this anyway, okay? I'm going to take you back a number of years when I was growing up. I can't tell you a number of times that I heard a statement like this, that the King James Version is the only version, every other version is a perversion. You may have to think about what I just said. Okay, but it was simply a reaction against modern translations. People were suspicious of it, preachers were suspicious of it, thinking that the King James Version is indeed the authorized version. Failing to realize that it was authorized by an Anglican, an Episcopalian, Church of England, not a Baptist, but thinking that that translation was always the one that God had blessed, the one that God had ordained, and some would go as far as saying, if it's good enough for Peter and Paul, it's good enough for me. Because they don't understand what that means. Okay? Now, having said that, if there would be times when, if you would be reading something publicly and in a church service other than the King James Version, people would get upset at you. Now, I use the King James Version because I thought every other version was a perversion. Okay? I've taken their word for it until I learned more about it later. Now, is there anything wrong with the King James Version? No. I mean, if you can learn Shakespeare, you can understand the King James Version. Okay? I mean, really, you can. However, it's not your language. What do you mean?
No, it's not. It's 1759 English. It's not 1611 English. Have you ever seen 1611? You can't read it. The words are spelled differently. Now, the one that's available is either the 1759 or 1769, one of those two. And so the words, we're more accustomed to the words, the spelling, and that kind of thing. But when I say it's not in our language, what I mean by that is language has changed so much that some of the things you will struggle to understand if you are not accustomed to the King James Version and understand how the words change. Let me give a couple of examples. One is in the rapture passage in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. It says in there that those of us who are alive will not prevent those who have fallen asleep. What does prevent mean?
Stop them.
Stop them. That's not what the text means, though. The word prevent in 1759 meant proceed. That's the way. We will not precede those who have fallen asleep, who have died. So there's that issue, and there's quite a few words that have kind of fallen out of usage that are a struggle to understand. How many of you understand the word circumspectly? You are to walk circumspectly. Anybody know what that means?
Didn't treat him.
It means carefully. It means live carefully. I'm not saying you can't understand it. I'm just simply saying when you make that the rule, whether a person is right with God or not, you probably have overstepped the boundaries. Because prior to 1611, what did the people use? Christians, what Bible translation they used? It was called the Geneva Bible. And before that, what did they use?
People
were Christian. Well, I'm still in English, so the English speaker, so yes, they did. They were available. But prior to that, what was available? Well, there was Tyndale's New Testament. But then when you back up a little further, you get into the Latin versions that were not in the language of the people. It was just the clergy understood Latin, and even the Mass was in Latin. So English speakers had no idea what was being said anyway. What am I meaning by that? Is sometimes we make a standard of fellowship and correct theology based on things that we probably shouldn't. The mistake of the Pharisees was he's just not lining up with us. He's not in agreement with us. Therefore, he must be casting out demons by the only other power available. We know it's not the power of God, because if he was doing it by the power of God, he would believe like us. Are you following what I'm saying? And Jesus wasn't. He wasn't hung up on their laws. Laws meaning their rules. And there's a bunch of those. Actually, around the Ten Commandments, there was 613 laws. Around the law, the Ten Commandments. Because the Pharisees and other religious leaders, they believed, common person is just not smart enough to know how to keep the Sabbath day. So we need to help them. And I'm going to give you some of the actual law. Ladies were forbidden to look into a mirror on the Sabbath. Reason why? You might see a gray hair, and if you pluck it, that's considered work, thereby violating the Sabbath. You could not eat an egg that a hen laid on the Sabbath, because the hen worked in laying that egg, unless you also eat the hen.
But how can you do that? Because you can't kill the hen. That would be work.
Well, you're punishing her because she did work. Another is, you are now. If you have an animal that you have to milk, whether it's a cow or a goat, or, you know, you do know that when the milk is coming in, you can't skip days. You know, that's why you see dairy farmers, even on Sundays or Saturdays or Christmas Day, if they need to be, they're out milking. Because you can't just let, you've got to do something about it, you know, you have to go out and milk. So there's a bright Pharisee, said, well, okay, that's true. So what you do is you milk your animal out on the ground. You're not catching the milk, so you're not working, you're just relieving the animal. Okay? And once somebody got the bright idea, well, I'll take a bucket and I'll take a rock and put it in the bottom of the bucket and I will milk the animal out, you know, the goat or whatever, out on that rock, and I just happen to catch the milk. But I'm not violating the law. You think these things sound silly, but it was very important. You were not to build a fire on the Sabbath because that was considered work. And if you ever go to Israel, if it's Saturday, make sure you know which elevator is a Sabbat elevator. Why? Because someone has determined that when you push that button, that starts an electrical current. That current is fire. That current is work. So the Sabbat, that means Sabbath, elevator stops on every floor automatically. So if you want to do a long ride, it goes to the floor, it stops, doors open up, you wait, you know, 20 seconds, it shuts, go to the next floor, pops open. You may assume we think those things are silly, but you know, people, they took it seriously. But they're missing the point. It's obvious. Is Satan going to cast out demons? Is Satan going to open the eyes of the blind? Is Satan going to raise the dead? Is Satan going to heal people? And the answer is no.
That's what they thought. Okay.
Look at the very last part in verse 35 and following. And Jesus went through all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every disease and every affliction. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Okay, we'll stop right there. And then he goes on. This is a usual summary passage. Jesus is preaching in the synagogues. He's healing every disease that he meets and the ailments of the people. So these are summaries. Not giving a specific example, just generally speaking, this is what's happening. But then in verse 37, he says something. And then he said to his disciples, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. Now, we could spend a lot of time on that particular verse. It's also repeated in other places. It's also in John chapter 4. It's alluded to there. No, not stated exactly like this. Do you remember what happened in John 4? The woman at the well? Okay, the woman at the well. After Jesus speaks with her, she leaves. And she goes into town. Jesus is at the well outside of town. She leaves and goes into town. And she tells everybody that she runs into about this man that knows everything about her. And her statements just drum up all kinds of curiosity. And it's almost like the whole town comes out to the well to see Jesus. Are you familiar with that? Well, the disciples come back as this woman is leaving, and they're wondering what has been going on there. And then Jesus engages his disciples. He says, don't stay the 4 months and then the harvest. Lift up your eyes. The field is white unto harvest. What is he looking at? He's looking at all of those people coming. He's not talking about crops. He's talking about people. And here,
Where are the laborers for the harvest? They're in the harvest. They're in the harvest. What do you mean? How many lost people do you interact with every day? You may not know. It may be, or how many lost people are you in a close relationship with? Probably not very many. I don't have that many, quote, lost friends either, because I spend most of my time with you all. All right? What happens when a pagan genuinely becomes a Christian? What kind of connections do they have? They have all their drinking buddies. They have all of their friends that are also pagans. So the longer you're a Christian, the fewer non-Christian friends you'll have. That's just statistics. Because we spend all our time with each other in different contexts. Or with other Christians and other churches and other ministries, that kind of thing. That's where we hang out the majority of the time. But you bring a lost person to Christ, or a lost person come to Christ, they have all kinds of connections with pagans. Because they were just shortly, not long ago, they were one. You see where the harvest is? That's where it is. That's where it really, really is. A quick story about a man named Joe. A college student. Joe was one of those guys that he was assigned. We had College of the Ozarks, at the time it was called School of the Ozarks, we had campus assigned jobs. We worked 20 hours a week and 3 40-hour work weeks a year, and it took care of tuition, room, and board. That way we could graduate without owing a dime. It was a good deal, really. My job was heating and air conditioning. But my bosses would not let us work on Freon units. Because the majority of the campus was cooled by river water coming from Lake Tanicomo, 52 degrees year-round. They'd pump it at big pumps, pump it up the hill, circulate it through all these things, and that was our air conditioning. They'd just work on those. We'd pull the crawdad parts and the moss and the sticks out of the different units. We could do that kind of, blow the mud out. They'd just do that kind of stuff. But anyway, that was our job. Somehow, I don't remember how Joe ended up in our group. But Joe hung around people who, for some reason, were named after Texas towns. There was Austin. There was Houston. And I don't remember some of the other names. Just, these are rough guys. Even going to a Christian school, these are rough guys. And you can always see they sat by each other at lunches and our meals, that kind of thing. You know, different affinity groups kind of grouped together. I can tell you where everybody sat. The jocks sat right over here. And the Aggies, they sit in the back. And they needed to. Who's going to eat with an Aggie? Because you're actually dealing with animals. It's not your book learning. You're also dealing with animals. Anyway, Joe's girlfriend, the one he thought for sure that he was going to marry, dumped him. All right? And Joe lived three doors down from the dormitory, from the room that I lived in. And, I mean, he was just heartbroken. I mean, he was pitiful. You know what I'm talking about when I say pitiful? Just pitiful. Here's this great big burly guy it's just pitiful. And I can't tell you. I'm at 3 o'clock in the morning. I walk to the door, open it, you know. I can't sleep. Neither can I. Good. Anyway, through that, we got Joe going to the Baptist BSU, Baptist Student Union. He became a Christian. And it was wild. He didn't know if it was Job or Job or Psalms. He didn't know. But he just ate everything up. We went to Kansas City to Midwestern Seminary on a college weekend or something, and this one woman, she did a dramatic monologue. You know what those are? She pretended to be a biblical character. She pretended to be the woman at the well. Fantastic job. Joe was so surprised and smooth by that. That rascal went out and bought her a dozen roses. Now, she's 25 years older. I mean, it's not like he just thought it was, that's what you're supposed to do, you know. And then, you know, and this is what happened in churches when you have a person like Joe, is other Christians will tolerate him for about 4 or 5 days, and then the wet blanket committee shows up. The wet blanket committee wants to tone him down. I want to, you know, because your presence convicts me that I'm not excited about the Lord like you are. So we got to calm him down. They don't say it that way, but it's exactly what they're going to do. So where's the harvest? It's in the harvest. Where are the workers, I should say? The workers that go out into the harvest, they're in the harvest. They're in the harvest. If you want to grow grapes, you better prune your grapevine. Because it's going to be the new growth is where the fruit is. It won't be the old growth. Leave it alone, and you'll have one of those spindly looking, you know, 2 or 3 grapes here and 3 or 4 grapes there. But if you prune it, the new growth will come out, and then it'll be the nice, if the Japanese beetles don't get them, you know. It'll be a very, you understand what I'm saying? Okay. All right. Next time, chapter 10. We'll see you then.